Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. My name is Ryan, and I'm an AmeriCorps member serving in the role of Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for UMP Watersheds. In today's episode, we'll feature an interview of Ken Carlone on Indigenous fire practices, as well as new understandings about climate fires. I want to start this show by recognizing that the land upon which UMP Watersheds is located was historically occupied by various Indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquel, and Malala, among others. Ken, I'm pretty new to the area. We didn't have wildfires where I grew up, but I understand that here it's part of the natural ecosystem. Can you give a brief overview of the history of the Pacific Northwest or Oregonian landscape?
Before Europeans arrived and brought their sensibilities about how land and forests should be managed, the native folks that were here, the indigenous people, used fire as a landscape management tool. And so when Europeans arrived, I mean, we all have this idea that Europeans arrived with axes and oxen and cleared the land. But that's actually not true. The land was already cleared. It was already maintained as very productive land that produced all of the resources that the local Indians needed. Opening up landscapes, that is, using fire to burn back the forests and to kill out all the small trees, maintained these open understory forests. So first of all, the forests were forests, and they had canopies over the top of them, but they were very open underneath. There wasn't a lot of brush and other material. And then there were lots of meadows embedded within the forests, and then in larger areas in the Umpqua Valley and the Willamette Valley and so on. And those were vast grasslands or savannas, and savannas are areas of grasslands that are dotted with widely spaced large trees. So that was what the landscape looked like here, and it was very much maintained in that state by the constant systematic burning by Indians. If fires weren't being used on a regular basis, much of these open habitats grew back into densely packed forests with lots of trees very close to each other. And so, and we know this because not only have there been ecological studies and scientific studies that have been done using various, you know, soil sampling methods and that sort of thing, but also we know from the earliest records of explorers coming through, notably David Douglas, who came through the area here in the 1820s, and the whole valley, he came down through the Willamette Valley and down into the Umpqua Valley in the fall, in September and October, and the whole landscape was burned. And in some cases, they had trouble finding enough grass for their horses. That's how extensive the burning was. And so he was one of the few white people that bothered to ask the Indians, why do you burn? What's going on? And the Indians told him that when most of the landscape is burned, but certain pockets are left green, the deer have to go to those areas to graze. And so it was very easy for them to get all their winter game to prepare, to dry and to smoke and to keep them through the winter, because the deer came to them. They didn't have to go out and find the deer. The deer went to the areas that weren't burned. And so all of the food, all of the fiber, all of the medicines that Indians needed and used could be maintained simply by burning on a regular basis in the right places at the right times. These folks had at least 10,000 years of practice burning the landscape, and so they knew what they were doing. They were you know, they could make fire do whatever they wanted it to do. And so not only did they maintain these open grasslands and savannas, but they brought fire right up into the forest and underburned in these stands where, if there are some great old photographs of Model Ts sitting out in the forest, because they could drive around out there. And with fire suppression that came in the early part of the 1900s, Europeans, you know, had gotten to the point where fire was bad. You know, you didn't let fire run around the landscape because it would burn down somebody's house. But in, you know, in the in the native system, their houses, their buildings, their structures that they made, number one, were, you know, if you lost one of them, well, that wouldn't be that big a deal to rebuild them. But they didn't lose them because they burned out away from their villages. So they made sure that their landscapes were very open, very burned, so that there wasn't enough fuel. So if lightning did hit near their camp and start a fire, it wouldn't come roaring at them like it does today. And so when European Americans, you know, that mostly it was the diseases that the Europeans brought with them, smallpox and measles and tuberculosis and so on, that just decimated the Indian populations here. There was a certain amount of warfare and a certain amount of friction between settlers and Indians, but by and large, the farmers and the Indians got along with each other. They understood each other. They understood, you know, what they were doing, and many of the farmers would hire Indians and so on. So the Indians and the farmers had good relationships. Unfortunately, the miners and the Indians, there was a lot of friction there, and that eventually led to the Rogue Wars and some other really kind of sad chapters in that history between Europeans and Indians. But as Indian management faded and faded and European management grew and grew, fire suppression became more and more and more the rule of the day. So rather than systematic fire ignitions that the Indians were doing, that gave way to systematic fire suppression by Europeans. And so in a lot of the areas that were open, those openings were maintained by grazing. And by the way, many ranchers continued to burn. They learned how to manage their landscapes from the Indians and continued to burn right up into the early part of the 1900s, when the government, having studied forestry in Europe and knowing how it was done, stopped the settlers from continuing to burn the landscape, and then began an all-out fire suppression. Any fire that started was to be immediately put out. Now, they weren't particularly good at that for the first few decades of the 20th century. But then when better communication, mechanization, aircraft, wireless communication became available, fire suppression took on very much of a military operation style response. And so fire was the enemy. You had command and control, you have hell attack, you have all the terminology that we use in the military to talk about attacking, you know, enemies is still used today. It got brought into the modern era. And so with the, you know, really post-World War II, when, you know, the middle of the last century, when a lot of aircraft became available, vehicles became available, more roads were put in, fire lookouts were established, that's when fire suppression really started to become effective. So about 70, 80 years ago is when we really began to be able to put out most fires. And so many areas that had not been forested, because the Indians had burned them year after year after year, became forested, and many of the areas that were forested with these large, you know, giant 4, 5, 6 foot trees spaced 60, 80 yards apart from each other around the forest, suddenly had a new cohort, a new group of trees grow up inside of them. And so that created a greater fuel load there. So that's one reason why fires have become more and more and more difficult to control in the last couple of decades. Really, a more important reason that fires have become more difficult to control is because of the European style of forest management, that is treating forests as a crop rather than as a forest. So, of course, the forests that Europeans inherited when they first arrived were very diverse forests. As I say, many of them were, you know, the trees were widely spaced. There was a lot of open understory. There was a lot of forage for game animals, and easily, you know, you could easily navigate those forests. When, again, after, you know, World War II, middle of the last century, the other thing that became very common is the chainsaw. And up until that point, trees were cut with enormous cross-cut saws with two guys on either side. You've probably seen the old photographs of the two loggers standing on springboards, these boards that they would poke into the sides of the trees so they could stand and chop this big face on one side. And it took them a couple of days. It took two strong young guys, you know, a couple, 3 days to cut down one of these big trees. So, you know, given that style of forestry, that was pretty much just what they call high grading. So they would walk into a forest and they would pick the 10 trees in this particular acre or whatever that were suitable for logging, and they cut those down and they leave the rest. But with the advent of chainsaws and mechanization to haul these big trees out of the forest and so on, that was when the era of clear cutting came in, where they would just start on one side of a ridge and cut all the way down to the bottom of the creek and up the other side, and every single tree on the landscape would be cut. And early on in the, you know, from the, you know, 40s and 50s when that started, up until the 1970s, there were no laws that said you had to replant after you cut, especially on private land. Public land was a little different, but people could just cut and walk away and let the forest come back naturally, which it would, which it does. But when in the early 70s, the Oregon Forest Practices Act was passed, it says that on private land and state-held land, if you clear cut, you must replant, and those trees must be free to grow. That is, they must be surviving and doing well within 6 years. So that brand new forest gets immediately reestablished as crews of tree planters go out there with hodads and tree bags and start slamming, you know, these little seedlings in 10 by 10. Because a natural forest, even if it's been clear cut and comes back, quote unquote, naturally, you know, maybe a handful of trees will get established in the first year and a handful in the second year. And so these forests are still fairly uneven aged. They grow at different rates. And so the tree crowns will land at different heights. Certainly the old growth forests that were here were very ragged in the crowns, right? A tree would blow down, there would be a hole. Young trees would come up there. You know, this tree might, you know, a little stand of trees might burn in a fire, right? And create maybe a 5 or 10 acre, you know, area that would be open. And so these forests were very chaotic, very heterogeneous, to use a big word, you know, lots of different kinds of structure. Whereas a plantation, all the trees are the same age, they're all growing at the same rate, and their crowns are touching pretty much from about, you know, 5 or 6 years into that plantation. It's a solid wall of trees that are all at the same height and their crowns are all touching each other. So in an old growth forest, when a fire starts, it will typically run along on the ground. And then in maybe, you know, maybe it's 100 degrees and there's 30 mile an hour winds and, you know, no humidity at say 5 in the afternoon. And the fire might get hot enough and intense enough to run up into the crown and kill a few trees from the top. But then it cools down in the evening, 7, 8, 9 o'clock, you know, the fire tends to drop down, fire intensity lowers, and it tends to crawl around under the forest very much the way the fires that the Indians set would burn. Well, when that fire hits a plantation and gets up into the crown of the plantation, there is nothing to stop that fire from jumping tree to tree to tree. And typically mortality, the death of those trees, is pretty much complete. Almost the survivability of trees in a plantation during a wildfire is practically zero. Now, there are situations where fire will jump around and the weather will do crazy stuff. And, you know, when a huge fire is burning, you can imagine that it actually impacts the weather. And so fire will oftentimes create its own weather, its own wind system that will blow the fire in certain ways that doesn't typically happen. So we're in a situation now because of the way Europeans have managed the forest as if it's a field of corn that just takes 50 or 60 years to grow instead of a season. We have created the structure to cause these very, very intense, fast-moving fires. And the conventional wisdom is that because old-growth forests are much bigger and have much more fuel, then they must be much more susceptible to fire, right? That must be, you know, because there's more fuel, these forests are listed as the most flammable forests, but that is exactly wrong. Because it is not the amount of fuel, it's the arrangement of the fuel. So it's not fuel volume, it's fuel structure that dictates how fire is going to behave in those forests. And so from the time of native folks who are creating, you know, fairly large fires in the open prairies and meadows, to lots of small fires in the forest. They're going to burn out around their camp. They're going to burn along the ridge to keep their roads open because the Indians traveled on the ridges, whereas Europeans with all their animals needed to travel along the creek bottoms because they needed water for their animals. So, well, the Indians didn't have pack animals. They were on foot. And so, you know, up until maybe the middle of the 1800s when horses were introduced to the Indians here. But up until that point, they just, everywhere they went, they walked or they ran. If you wanted to get someplace, those were your two choices. And so they had to keep their roads open and fire did that. They had to keep their camps cleaned out so that a lightning strike didn't cause a problem if it happened in August when the people were still up in the forest gathering and hunting as they did. And the other interesting thing that I'll just add in there too is that Indians were very mobile and they, instead of having a village that they lived in year round, they would tend to have fairly well-established villages in the low country, down in the valleys here on the Umpqua Valley and so on. But then in the summertime, the whole village, they would abandon that village and all of the people would march 40, 50, sometimes 60 miles up into the mountains and set up their summer camps. And that's where the people from the Klamath side and the Malala people and the Takelman people, the Rogue people, and the Kalapuya people, they would all come up into the mountains at the same time. And that's where they met. That's where they did their business deals and they married off their children and they figured out who was going to be the hunt chief, because oftentimes what they would do is they would have these large large fire circle hunts where they would light fires in a large circle and move in as and scare the game into the center. And so they would get a whole bunch of their meat in the summertime from the fires that they would light in the forests, which maintained the habitat for the game that they ate later on, and also maintained those open understory forests that were so valuable for them in terms of all their food and their fuel and their fiber and all of their needs. So that was then. And as we gradually move more and more and more toward European management, you have these widely spaced open understory forests becoming very dense with vegetation. And you have areas that had been those kinds of forests clear cut and turned into plantations where the resistance to fire, their ability to be able to survive fire is very, very, very much lower than the original old growth forests were. So that's kind of our situation today, how we've gotten from, 150 years ago of these, widely distributed cathedral old growth forests, lots of space in between, and meadows, large meadows and oak savannas, to now these heavily stocked, very dense primary forests, native forests, which there are not that many left, and the quote unquote managed forests that are now all even aged plantations.
Where are we now? Now that the indigenous people have largely been pushed out and settler or colonist ways of thinking and land use practices, which aren't always in tune with the local ecosystem, have taken over. I didn't know if you wanted to add anything else about the current state of things, especially with this year's unprecedented, or at least to us, unprecedented wildfires.
Yeah, that's a good point, because it's not just sort of where we've gotten to now at a landscape level, right? How our forests have changed, how our grasslands have changed, and that sort of thing. But unfortunately, at a global scale, we also have a very different situation than Native folks had, and even the original Europeans had, because we now have, after 150 years of humans all over the planet burning fossil fuels and putting all of those greenhouse gases, so-called greenhouse gases, into the atmosphere, climate change is a factor that people hadn't, well, I shouldn't say that. We have been looking at that. People have been concerned about that. People have been modeling how climate change is going to affect forests for now a couple of decades. But what wasn't well predicted anyway, some people did predict it, is the fact that we now have weather patterns that are completely different than those of both the Native Americans and the original Europeans that arrived here. We're recording this in November of 2020, having gone through, the worst wildfire season in Oregon history. And I've lived here since 1982. And occasionally, every 10 or 15 years, we would have an event, usually in late November or early December, where we'll get this unseasonably warm wind that will come out of the east. And these are very similar to the Santa Ana winds that happen in the Sierras in California. But I have never seen one happen in early September with the ferocity that this wind created. It was 55 miles an hour, from what I understand. And so instead of fires burning and maybe creating their own weather, certainly Indian fires were lots of small fires instead of few big fires. But even the bigger and bigger fires that we've been seeing over the last couple of decades have not been driven by 50 to 60 mile an hour winds. And so this is a new reality for us to cope with now as forest managers and people who want to live in areas where there are forests, is that climate change, these fires, the Archie Creek fire and the Holiday Farm fire, and then, you know, up and down the west side of the Cascades, those are climate fires. Those are different, very different from the traditional fires that we had. Even with the fuel situation having changed, as I mentioned before, we have to prepare ourselves for situations where there are going to be these walls of fire coming at us out of the east. You know, our weather typically comes out of the west, you know, off the ocean, right? We're not used to having warm, intense winds coming at us from the opposite side of the world. And so, of course, that's blowing the fire down through the forested area into our communities. And so that's something that we're really going to have to come to terms with. And I have some ideas about that. I have a feeling you're going to ask me about that.
Yeah. I was going to say, for sure. Yeah. How can we move forward? I know that harvesting timber has been a way of life for many people in the area. But we can easily get into that plight of not seeing for the forest for the trees. You know, like you said, if we only view forests as sources of lumber for human consumption, that kind of thing, how's there, like, do you see a way to find balance with that?
I do. And let me give you an example, a concrete example of something that we're doing. I'm working with a group of people known as the Ewe Creek Land Alliance, and we have 380 acres of land in southern Douglas County. And that land had been a ranch since the 1850s and had been continuously grazed until the late 1960s. And also, it had been originally forested. Well, I shouldn't say it. There were lots of meadows, lots of savannas, and chunks of forest. So it was a very diverse, quite beautiful landscape. And it backs up now to a remnant stand of low elevation old growth, only about 2,300 feet elevation, where there are five and a half foot diameter trees still there. And so that's our model, right? So that's on federal land, on BLM land. Our land is to the south of what the kids that grew up in the area call the magic forest. And it really is magic. It's got five or six species of native orchids that grow in the forest floor. It's got spotted owls living in it. It's just a fabulous forest. So that's our model. The ranch has been completely logged. By the end of the 60s, there was not a stick of timber that was worth a dime that was not taken off that ground. Well, what happened shortly after that, the ranch went bankrupt. And the land has been, quote unquote, unmanaged since the late 1960s. So 50, 60 years of growth in there, where all of the seed, we're lucky in that all of the seedlings are from native seed sources. So back in those days, when they would have been replanting that, had they been required to, they didn't understand seed sources. They didn't understand that if you took seeds from the east side of the Cascades and planted them on the west side of the Cascades, they might do okay for a while, but then they'll eventually fail. And so we would have had this soldier rows of 10 foot by 10 foot grids of offsite trees that were very unhealthy. Fortunately, we have a very healthy stand of conifers, so healthy, unfortunately, that the remnant large oaks and large madrones on the property that never had any value, they were too big to bother to cut for firewood. They never had any value as lumber. They're still there. We have a madrone on the property that's 6 feet in diameter. We have oaks that are four and a half feet in diameter. So these giant old legacy oaks and madrones that are there, probably on the order of 300 to 400 years old, were never were never cut. They're still there. But in the absence of fire, because madrone and oak and pines were there too, we're trying to reestablish the pines that were there as well. Those are very fire tolerant species. And so when fires burn through, especially cool, quick fires that burn grasslands, right? Not a lot of fuel, not a lot of heat. Their big, thick bark can protect them from the fires. Well, in the absence of the fires, all of these young, healthy Douglas fir and incense cedar, mostly, and some of the ponderosa pine, are all growing up inside the crowns of those hardwood trees. And if we did nothing, if we just stood and let, quote unquote, nature take its course, what would happen is those small conifers would overwhelm those massive, spectacular old oaks and madrones, and it would kill them. And so we're going in with chainsaws to emulate fire. So we're going in and we're cutting those conifers that have all grown in around those oak trees to release those oak trees from that competition so they can continue to survive. They can continue to produce the acorns that support 200 different species of creatures on the west side of the Cascades. And the madrones that produce berries that right now the huge flock of robins at my place just gorging on madrone berries right now. So those are very important keystone species that provide food for lots and lots of other species. And just to take a brief minute to explain what I just meant by a keystone species. The word comes from the trapezoidal shaped, another big word, stone at the top of an arch. Okay, if you think of an old Roman arch or an old stone arch in an old castle, there's this wedge-shaped stone that sits at the top. If you take that stone out, the whole arch collapses. So scientists use that word keystone species for a species that if you removed it from the ecosystem, that system would collapse and be something very different than it originally was. And so these large old oaks and madrones are a keystone species on the landscape that support a whole bunch of other diversity underneath them. And so if we allowed those conifers to kill those trees, to just stand back and not do anything, we would see a depletion of diversity on our property.
We'll be right back to continue our interview with Ken. Are you an avid reader? Then you should join Umpqua Watershed's book club. Turning Over a New Leaf is a book club for teens and adults who are interested in learning about environmental issues and working to make positive change. We meet once a month to discuss a book or topic. All right, let's hear more about how humans have been part of the ecosystem and could be going forward.
If we think about that idea of a keystone species, really, Native Americans were a keystone species on the landscape because they controlled the fire regimes. They controlled when fire burned and when it burned to maintain this terrifically rich biodiverse landscape that Europeans discovered when they first arrived. And so we're trying to take back over that role of the human steward management that Indians, managed their lands. They were stewards of their lands, and their life histories were very sustainable. And how do we know that? Because we know that for 3,000 years, their culture really didn't change, which suggests they got it right about 3,000 years ago. And as long as it keeps working, you don't fix it, right? Especially in a very traditional society where traditions are passed down by word of mouth from elders to youngers and so on. And so we have a very good idea that this was a very sustainable way of managing the landscape because it sustained their cultures for all those years. So, as I say, what we're doing is we are now going in and cutting those trees. Some of those trees are 50 or 60 years old. And so I think we've taken in this last, oak restoration process, we've taken 15 truckloads of logs out of that forest and sent them to the local mill for people to have jobs to mill into lumber that you buy at Home Depot, right? We're also using some of the logs that have too much defect or don't make mill specifications for one reason or another. And we're milling them into lumber that we're going to use up at U Creek on the property to build infrastructure to hopefully one day create an educational facility up there, kind of a field station where students can come and learn and experience that style of forest management. So what we're trying to model what sustainable forestry looks like. We're not tree huggers in the sense that we don't know where our lumber comes from and, we don't want anybody to cut anything. And that's not at all who we are. We're very pragmatic managers. Yeah, we hug a tree once in a while, but, we also cut them down. And so that our legacy trees can survive, so that we can manage our forest to be productive into the future as far as any generation can go. So, how do we deal? Okay, that's a 380-acre demonstration project that we're doing, right? We're trying to model sustainable forestry that can sustain. We're, hopefully we project that we'll be able to probably keep 3 to 4 jobs going, continuously by continuing that work and continuing to mill the timber that we produce in the process of restoring the traditional structure of that landscape. What do we do with these massive plantations that are all over the forest here? I get that a criticism of my work is that, well, yeah, sure, that's a little boutique operation that you got going there, and you'll never be able to scale that up. I would argue that we're doing this as a model for how to scale up. How can industrial forests manage their land to create the timber that produces the jobs at the mill that as you mentioned before, that we all depend on, and we have depended on ever since, the county was settled by Europeans. So there's really kind of three things to think about. First of all, we've got a lot more structures, a lot more people's homes are built in fire vulnerable areas now that were not there before. The interesting thing about that is that if you look at a lot of these structures that burned, you'll see green trees. Because what causes a structure to burn down are the embers that are coming in as the fire is approaching. And so if you have leaves and pine needles in your gutters, there's going to be an ember that's going to land there. It's going to light that on fire. It's going to burn your house. If you have open gable vents, right, to get circulation in your attic, which most people do, if they're not screened, as that wind blows by, it's going to create a tunnel that's going to suck those embers into your attic, and it's going to burn your house down. If you have wood shake shingles on your roof, if you have flammable shrubs all around your house, if you have wood chips all around your foundation, that's going to burn your house down. So first and foremost, we need to look at changing building codes for people that build in a lot of people are going to be rebuilding their homes in these fire-prone areas. How do you do it in a way that you don't just set yourself up to have the house burned down again? Okay. And so for a long time, I mean, for, oh, probably a most of a decade now, there's been the FireWise program that is encouraging people to clear defensible space around their house. 100 feet around your house, you can have a roaring, and I've seen experiments done where they actually lit a forest on fire, and they had little model houses at 30 feet, 60 feet, 100 feet, and the close ones burned, but the ones that were 100 feet away with this roaring fire, you know, forest fire burning 100 feet away, did not burn the house down. So we need to harden our structures, make them more fire safe. We need to make sure that the surrounding area around the houses gives that house defensible space. So those are two important things we need to do. The next thing we need to do, you know, the third thing from a local perspective, from a landscape level perspective, is to reconfigure those plantations. So there are all these even age plantations out there, even age stands. We need to be able to go in and mess them up. We need to make them look more like native forests. Separate the crowns. That's another thing that we did out at U Creek. That's the first thing we did there, because we had a fire burn around us to the west and then burn across the south of our property, and it didn't burn up into our property, and it would have taken out all of that timber that nobody ever managed. So the first thing we did was thinned our conifer forests so that we separated the crowns so that it's much more difficult for a fire to move from crown to crown to crown. And we also created a buffer area where we reestablished the oak savanna on the ridge so that when the fire comes up, this wicked flammable plantation that a major timber company owns just to the south of us, we'll have a chance to lay it down on the road on the ridge and either stop it there or at least get it down on the ground and out of the crowns. If it does start burning into our timber, well, at least we'll have a shot at keeping it on the ground. So that's what we need to do to forests around where people live. Now, there are two competing schools of thought in the conservation community about what to do in the backcountry. What do you do if there's no houses around and there's no danger of houses burning down? There's one group of folks that said, leave it alone. Don't mess with it. You know, it's storing carbon. Okay. I get that. However, the old growth stands that are embedded, that used to be a sea of old growth with little islands of openings or even age stands. Now it's the opposite. There's a sea of even age plantations with islands of old growth in them. That old growth, number one, they are treasure chests full of genetic diversity. And number two, they're treasure chests full of carbon, of stuff that we don't want to turn into greenhouse gases. And so there's where I kind of argue with my conservation colleagues, and I say it's important to get into the backcountry as well, because we need to improve the survivability of not only the plantations that surround these old growth stands, but the old growth stands themselves. And so yes, people's houses are important. We need to firewise communities, and we need to harden our structures. Old islands of old, remnant old growth, there's like 5% of the stuff left of the original. One side says 10, the other side says less than 5. So let's say 7, okay? That still, single digit percentage of that original habitat is left. And again, that's our storehouse of biodiversity. You know, that's where the new medicines that we haven't even discovered yet live. You know, the Pacific yew that lives in those forests, the bark has a compound in it called Taxol, And that is has become very effective as a treatment for breast cancer. So we don't know, we don't even know the values of the various, you know, chemicals that are being produced by these pharmacological factories out there, you know, these giant, you know, drug manufacturers, and we don't even know what the drugs are yet. Okay, so we need to protect those. I would argue that's just as important, okay, in a different way. It's just as important as protecting people's houses, is to protect, you know, the unknown values to society that reside in those old growth forests. And so I believe that there is another source of timber to provide to local mills to make into lumber and various other timber products to, you know, for the American market. More, that's going to need more and more of that stuff as hurricanes come barreling in one after the other into the, you know, the Gulf Coast and destroy homes there. And then, you know, thousands of, you know, structures were destroyed in these fires in September. So we're going to, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, I mean, we don't need to get wood from somewhere. We do. And we don't need to get them from tropical rainforests and other forests that don't have the protections that our forests have. We can produce, I'm a believer that we can have our cake and eat it too. We can protect the best and the most valuable forests out there, the ancient old growth forests, while we improve the diversity and the ability to resist wildfires of the plantations that are already there. Reconfiguring, logging in a way that not only provides logs to the mill, but also separates the crowns of those trees and increases, doesn't guarantee, there's no guarantee, if you get a 60 mile an hour wind driven fire, everything burns. Okay. But in a quote unquote normal fire, a regular old, you know, 20th century fire, you know, that's much more survivable. I think the last thing I would say is that I've been focused on what you can do around your house, you know, what you can, or to your house and around your house, and at sort of a landscape level across the Cascades and so on in the Coast Range, right? The last thing to think about, though, is what's causing these new climate fires, right? Okay, we know the answer to that, right? We've been producing way too many greenhouse gases for the last 150 years. They are changing the climate in a way that makes these fires much less predictable and much more dangerous. And so we can think globally while we're acting locally. Okay, so there are local solutions that will ultimately lead to less, you know, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. And to a large extent, you know, we can do that with our forest practices. And kind of one last thing I'll say about that, again, going back to our Yew Creek project that we're doing on that 380-acre forest, one of the things that we're doing is when we cut that timber, a lot of the trees are too small to be turned into lumber. And then when you do cut a tree that's going to go on a log truck, you cut all the limbs off and you cut the top, right? So we have literally tons and tons of this woody material that, you know, we've created. Now, when you just leave that laying all over the ground for 3 to 5 years, you are asking for a major fire, right? Because if anything comes in, even embers are coming in and spotting in, they're going to light that slash on fire, and you're going to have, you know, you're going to have fire everywhere. Okay. So we've got to get rid of that slash. What's typically done today? Either a bunch of people out there drag it and pull it into a pile, or machines are out there and grab it and pile up these, make these huge piles, some of them the size of houses. And then they come by with a match and throw it in the fall when it's, you know, like this. and the weather is cool and moist. And they just burn it and turn it all into CO2. They turn it all into greenhouse gas. What we're doing, we did a pilot project. We were the first in the state of Oregon to do this under a government program that Natural Resources Conservation Service is paying us to take that slash, to take that woody, the branches and tops and so on. And we've designed and built several different styles of small mobile kilns that we take into the field with us, and we take that slash and we char it into charcoal. And so you say, well, what could possibly be the point of doing that? Well, it turns out that when you heat wood in the absence of oxygen, which is what our kilns do, it leaves charcoal behind. Just like when you damp your wood stove down too hard, right, in the night, and you open it up in the morning and there's a bunch of just charcoal in there, right? Because you haven't let enough oxygen in there to burn it all the way up. It turns out that when you convert wood to charcoal, the soil microbes, all the little critters, the bacteria and fungus that normally breaks down that wood, that would normally break that wood down, are unable to access the biochar, we call it. Because once it's turned into charcoal and it goes into the soil, it has all of these amazing properties. It absorbs water and holds water. It helps the soil, to be aerated. It will store nutrients that would normally leach out when the rains come and the water runs off into the rivers and streams. It carries a lot of those nutrients away. Biochar holds on to them, and so it helps the forest grow and capture more carbon as it does. But the other, I think, most interesting thing about it is because it can't be broken down by microbes, that char stays in the soil for centuries to millennia. And the studies that have been done show that the half-life, the time it takes for half the stuff to break down, is over 1,000 years. So we're making the equivalent of fossil fuel. We're making the equivalent of coal and oil, and we're putting it back in the ground. Huh. It's all going the opposite way, right? You take the coal and the oil out, you burn it, and it turns into CO2. We're doing the opposite. We're taking some of that wood that would break down over the next 10, 20, 30 years and be released as carbon dioxide, because as we breathe out, what do we breathe out? Carbon dioxide, right? So do all the microbes that are breaking down that wood. They're breathing out carbon dioxide. And so it, if it doesn't burn, all that slash, it breaks down over time and adds that carbon to the atmosphere. We're getting somewhere between a third and a half of the carbon that's in that slash charred into a material that won't break down and will stay in the soil for hundreds or thousands of years. So we think that as a way to reconfigure forests, as we're doing that, rather than just thinning these forests, making big piles of slash and burning it off, that if we can capture a third to a half of that carbon into charcoal that won't break down for many, many, many decades, let's do that. That's also, I think, a really good way to deal with firewising kinds of, that we need fire in the forest and we need fire close to homes. But it's dangerous when it's close to homes. So if we can keep fire in little metal boxes, we're still doing the same thing that fire used to do to the system, but we're controlling the fire and we're controlling the product of that fire.
Well, thank you for all the insights and experience and ideas that you've shared with us today. I know I've learned a lot, especially someone new to the area, but I'm so grateful to have had you on the show.
It's great to be here, and it's great to talk about fire and what we're doing and how we can move forward.
The intro and outro music for this show are excerpts from the song Forest by Vlad Gluchenko, used under the Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. You can find more information about this song in Living Downstream's information section.